bills for afternoon session. We only have one case set for oral argument today. And I will ask the clerk to call the case. Counselor, Mr. Orsinger, are you ready?
We are ready, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Proceed. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Richard Orsinger, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Amy Holloman. I will be giving the 15-minute primary argument, and Stephen Orsinger will give our 5-minute rebuttal.
Is Stephen Orsinger related to you?
Yes, it is my son. He's a licensed lawyer. He's been licensed a little over 4 years.
Good.
We're asking the court today to consider 4 aspects of the case decided below that we think are committed reversible error. The first one has to do with the primary custody of a minor child. The second one with the allocation of parental rights, particularly the decision, exclusive right to make a decision of significance on education and on mental health care. The third component of the appeal is error in the property division, which we believe is close to or exceeds 100% to zero. And the final issue is the award of appellate attorney's fees in the way that it was awarded, and so that it appears that it's not reviewable on appeal. So we've raised constitutional arguments because of that. The standards of review are slightly different, so I wanted to start with the standards of review on the jury verdict. We are bringing a factual sufficiency challenge, not a legal sufficiency challenge. And so under the established law, the factual sufficiency challenge requires the appellate court to review all the evidence for and against the decision that the jury made. Under the City of Keller case decided by the Supreme Court that, if you will, revamped and modernized sufficiency of the evidence review, they said that when a jury makes a decision that reasonably jurors could agree upon, that it can't be overturned by an appellate court. And if it's a factual sufficiency review, this is the court of last resort for factual sufficiency review. But if in your assessment and the weighing of all of the evidence you feel like that the jury's decision falls outside what the Supreme Court called the zone of reasonable disagreement, then it's your constitutional and statutory responsibility to reverse the jury verdict and remand the case for a new trial.
Can I ask you a question, please?
Yes, Judge.
I'm curious to know, do you think that under the standard of review for factual sufficiency, we review all the evidence in a neutral light or in the light most favorable to the verdict?
I don't think you have to review it in the light most favorable to the verdict. In my view, that is a legal sufficiency standard, and that means that if it's slightly more than a scintilla of evidence, you have to uphold the decision. But in my view, you're weighing the evidence for and against, and if you were to apply a presumption against or make all inferences in favor of the jury verdict, then you wouldn't be weighing all the evidence. You'd be disregarding part of it. So that's my position on that. I'm not aware of the Supreme Court having taken a clear stand on that.
There's a footnote in a criminal case where the Court of Criminal Appeals abolished factual sufficiency.
Yes.
In the Brooks case, where I think it's just Judge Cochran says she thinks it's that civil courts view factual sufficiency review in the light most favorable to the verdict. And I agree. I don't think that's right.
Yes.
I don't agree with her.
Yes. Well, you know, they went through a period of time where they had sufficiency review that's familiar to those of us on the civil side, and then they decided to get rid of it. And so they have a different interpretation there. And so at any rate, having that context, the decision about the exclusive powers of the father to make decisions on education and psychological treatment is reviewed by an abuse of discretion standard. And the case law indicates that there's not a specific definition for abuse of discretion. We've cited the court to the Heritage Resources cases decided by El Paso Court of Appeals. And they articulated it as whether, based on the elicited evidence, the trial court made a reasonable decision, or stated conversely, we must conclude that the trial court's decision was neither arbitrary nor unreasonable. So with those two standards in mind, I'd like to start out with the testimony in front of the jury. First of all, the trial judge, over objection, admitted the court's temporary orders. And in the temporary orders, the father was awarded primary custody of the child, and the mother was given only standard possession, and she was required to pay child support, and the father was put in the party's home with the minor child. And there's recitals in here. The following orders are for the safety and welfare and best interest of the following child. And then on one paragraph on the duration of the order, on page 11, the period of possession ordered above apply to the child, the subject of this suit, while that child is under the age of 18 years and not otherwise emancipated. That particular sentence makes it sound like it's a perennial award during the minority of the child. The very last line of the temporary orders said that they remain in force until the signing of the decree. But these temporary orders were marked and offered over the objection of my client's trial counsel that this was an improper comment of the weight of the evidence, and we believe that it has no evidentiary import. The design, I suspect, and the effect on the jury, we believe, was to tell the jury that the trial judge found that it was in the best interest of the child that the father be the primary custodian. And marking an offer that into a jury trial is a way of having the judge comment on the weight of the evidence, which is why my counsel below objected to that, and the objection was overruled. So we believe that that was prejudicial, especially when you consider that there were 2 years and 5 months that went by between the temporary orders being signed and the trial starting. So here we had a situation where the judge made a preliminary decision. It lasted for 2 years, almost 2.5 years. It had a recital that that award would be in best interest, and that was introduced into evidence as a judicial statement. Judge, did you? I couldn't tell. Okay. Let me then say that in addition to that, we would like to appoint the court to the court-appointed psychologist, Dr. Flynn, a man who's exceptionally well qualified. He's been a psychologist for 30 years. He has a law license. He was court-appointed by the court in this case. He's done several hundred custody evaluations. He prepared a psychological report in this case. He tested both the husband and the wife, or the mother and the father, and found that the husband was, the testing showed he was prone to unpredictable outbursts of anger. And he recommended that the mother, Amy Halliman, be appointed as the primary custodian for the child. Now, he was attacked primarily on two grounds, in the trial court, in the appellate brief, and also findings of the trial court that support this. Dr. Flynn, they said, deviated from acceptable standards by failing to interview the child. And actually, if you look at the family code provisions that govern this, you'll find that, first of all, the family code requires that the professional conduct themselves in conformance with the professional standard of care applicable to the person's licensure. And Dr. Flynn testified that he felt like this was a high conflict situation and that the child was discomfited by this fact, and he did not want to interview the child separately. So instead, he interviewed the child with the mother and interviewed the child with the father. And he said he felt like that was professionally appropriate. Also, if you look at the family code section that Appellee relies on, which is Family Code Section 107.0514, it merely requires an interview conducted in a developmentally appropriate manner. It doesn't require that the interview be done separately from either or both parents. So the criticism that his opinion is defective because he didn't conduct a separate interview in violation of the Family Code, which the trial court adopted as a finding of fact, is in fact incorrect. The family code doesn't require that it be accepted. It just requires that it be developmentally appropriate, and the child was age 4. The other criticism they brought was that Dr. Flynn didn't check with the collateral witnesses that had been submitted by the husband. But his report and his testimony indicate that he did not differentiate who recommended that the particular collateral. He interviewed the collateral witnesses that he thought were important. If you look at Family Code Section 107.0514A4, and this is all in our brief, it requires that the professional obtain information from relevant collateral sources. It doesn't require that you interview everyone that's submitted by either the mother or the father, whoever's seeking custody. So again, he didn't violate the Family Code in doing this, but that was what the jury was told in argument, and apparently the judge agreed with that because the judge has a finding to that effect. So this man, this independent professional's opinion and recommendation was discounted and attacked heavily in the trial court, apparently successfully as far as the judge was concerned, on the grounds of two defects that were in fact not defects at all. and we believe that this contributed to the jury disregarding his recommendation that the mother have custody. Additionally, there was a witness named Yes, sir.
Do you contend on the argument of trial counsel that those two factors should be considered by the jury in arriving at what verdict it might give in terms of accepting or not accepting Glenn's recommendations?
If I understand your question, I'm not saying that it was that the argument was error, even though I think it was wrong. But I don't think it's fair to discredit the opinion of a professional on grounds that are invalid. And I wasn't there at trial. I don't know why certain arguments were not made to counter the argument that he didn't follow the family code. But my analysis of the family code provisions is that this man did not violate the family code and, in fact, upheld the provisions about...
Well, in terms of the jury findings, you know, you're looking at those, not the fact that the findings of fact by the trial judge,
right,
but about what the jury did.
Right.
If the argument was not objected to, it was made at the time when the trial judge allowed the argument, and then the jury went to the jury room with that argument. I mean, I'm not understanding how you're looking at that as an error as far as the jury part of this is concerned.
I'm not saying it's an error. I'm saying that it's an indication that we think the jury considered that in disregarding the more legitimate evidence. And in your role as a Court of Appeals judge, which is constitutional as well as statutory, you have to decide whether the factors or the evidence that was properly admitted and properly considered is outweighed by the contrary evidence.
Well, I'm concerned about your analysis of what our duty would be as we said, as panel looking at the factual findings made by the jury, because it's only one question asked, no one objected to the charge, and the answer was clearly only a nay. And that's, to me, I don't see how you're getting to a factual sufficiency review in that case. Because when you say that our job is not to give credence or give any kind of preference to the jury findings, but instead we're to weigh all of the evidence. We don't have the people in front of us to look at, listen to, make a judgment about their demeanor. And every jury trial I know of is usually started by somebody saying, no more than ours, that you're entitled to listen to all of the testimony, but you don't have to give credence to any of it if you don't want to. And if that's the basic tenet of what our juries are doing, looking at people at a trial, it gives me concern that whenever the objective might be for an appellate court to throw out that jury's verdict, looking at all those witnesses, and for us to say instead, okay, we're just going to read the pages and weigh right there whether that jury was right or wrong in one answer to one question in the jury trial.
I understand exactly what you're saying, and it's perhaps even almost a judicial philosophy point, but the Constitution and the statute do say that the Court of Appeals is responsible to be sure that the jury verdict falls within norms that the appellate court feels are acceptable norms. They may vary from case to case, and they may vary from justice to justice. And your line may be drawn in a different place from another justice's line, but it is your responsibility to make that analysis. And we believe there are good reasons to see in this record that we had a lengthy period of time under temporary orders. We had the improper admission, properly objected to, of the orders themselves, which constitute a comment on the weight of the evidence. We have what we consider to be a spurious attack on the legitimacy of the independent professional. And then we have several other considerations. Attacks on Amy, one of the major attacks was that she made a succession of reports to Child Protective Services that were invalid. The only evidence shows that she participated in the first report, which was done by the child's therapist, who testified she was required by law to do it, and asked Amy to join her. Amy was accused of having done these other CPS reports, but there's no evidence that she did. So, Judge, I don't know what to say. It's a matter of judicial philosophy, but we know the Constitution and the statutes expect this court to be the last word on whether that jury verdict fell within the norms. And what we're suggesting is that this jury verdict is outside the norm, and we've identified several prejudicial issues that we think are misconceived that influence the jury. We don't know that for a fact. We didn't interview them. Their thoughts are not in the record. But we think that, Judge, this record will support the Court of Appeals looking at it and deciding that the verdict was I appreciate that, Judge, and my time is...
Excuse me. I'm trying to fit your complaints into the pigeonholes for having been properly raised on appeal in the briefs. Are they, could we categorize them as complaints of improper admission into evidence? And I'm talking about the orders, the temporary orders, the whether or not, whether the counselor properly interviewed the child alone with parents. And I think there's a third one. That there was no evidence actually that she made the accusations the second or third time. Are those in the nature of complaints of improper admission into evidence?
Not
a matter of law, like incompetent evidence?
Not really, Judge, because the standard for error on the admission of evidence is whether it was reasonably calculated to lead to an improper judgment. And so it's, I think, very difficult to say that the error of admitting those temporary orders signed by the judge over objection was reasonably calculated to lead to an improper judgment. We're offering it more in the context of when you're reviewing the evidence that's for and against the jury's verdict, we had a piece of evidence that didn't belong in there. Maybe we can't say that that one piece of evidence alone was reversible error because it reasonably calculated to lead to impermissible, reversible error. But we're saying in combination, when you consider the objective evidence, the third parties, the court-appointed experts, against the evidence in favor of the jury verdict, when you take those cumulatively, we believe it shows the jury verdict fell outside the scope of reasonable agreement. I hope I clarified it for the court because...
You did.
If we're attempting to reverse just on a piece of evidence, we have to show how that led to reversal. And I don't have the time to cover, so I'll have to refer to the briefs on the property division, which we think was 100% to one, and then the constitutional question about why don't we have a constitutional right to appellate review of the interim fees. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Orsinger. And so now we will hear from Rebecca Tilley.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Rebecca Tillery, and I'm here today representing the appellee, Edward Halliman. The judgment of the trial court below should be affirmed for two reasons. First, the jury's verdict awarding Edward the exclusive right to determine the primary residence of the child was supported by factually sufficient evidence. And secondly, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in awarding Edward certain exclusive decision-making rights, nor in its division of property. I would like to address more or less in the order that counsel did some of the issues he raised here at oral argument. First, his argument about the temporary orders being admitted into evidence over objection of trial counsel. When you go to the place in the record where that actually happened, which was in the supplemental volume 2, page 220 through 222, what actually had happened at that point in time, and this was, I believe, at least the second day of the jury trial, it may have been the third day, what had happened in that case is Amy's witness was putting on testimony about a day of Edward's possession and that he had taken the child out of daycare. And at that point in time, in order to prove up what the possession schedule was that these parties were operating under, Mr. Robertson, the trial counsel for Edward, offered into evidence the temporary orders. So this was not something that in the beginning, first day of trial, we're waving around the temporary orders and saying, here's what the judge already did, and let's offer them into evidence on day one. It was offered into evidence specifically to essentially, I don't want to use the word impeach because I don't think it was impeachment evidence, but it was essentially to support the reasoning that Edward had for taking the child out of daycare on that certain day. And that's when the temporary orders came into evidence. And I don't believe it's a comment on the judge way, on the judge's decision in the temporary orders.
So in essence, what you're telling us is that it's offered for a limited purpose, but that's not in the record.
I believe it was offered for a limited purpose. Sitting here right now, I can't tell you for sure whether or not the record evidences that clearly enough, but I believe it does. I believe the objections were on the record and not up at the bench. But either way, without doubt, the jury was aware of the possession order, generally speaking, that had been going on for the prior 2.5 years. There's no two ways about that. Whether the temporary orders, the physical temporary orders, went into evidence or not, there was enough discussion and enough testimony about what the current situation was that the jury understood what had been going on for the last 2.5 years. But as opposed to what counsel would argue, I don't believe there's any reversible error in that. When we discuss child-related issues, as we are here, the paramount concern is always the best interest of the child. So, of course, the trial court and the jury is in the position of evaluating what is in the best interest of this child today, on this day in this courtroom. And if the child had been operating under temporary orders for two-plus years and thriving under them, which is what was admitted even by Amy herself at trial, the child had been thriving under these temporary orders, then certainly that's something that the trial court and the jury should know and that they should take into consideration when talking about the best interest of the child. And Mr. Orsinger used the word fair, that this wasn't fair. But respectfully, when we're talking about kiddo issues, it doesn't matter what's fair or not fair to one party or another. The paramount concern, the most important concern, is what is in the best interest of this child. We can talk about fair when we get to the property division, but right now, the concern that the jury and the trial court had to have number one in their mind was what is in the best interest of this child. And certainly, whether or not this child had been thriving under these temporary orders was part of that best interest determination. To take counsel's argument to its logical conclusion, you would almost have to instruct a jury to close their eyes and cover their ears and pretend that the last 2.5 years hadn't been happening. Just pretend this is day two of the divorce proceeding. And that's not what the jury and the trial court is supposed to do. They have to look at the totality of the evidence. And certainly in this case, the jury and the trial court heard ample testimony and ample evidence about how the parties were prior to the divorce, how the parties were during the divorce, and how the parties were and how this child was doing at the time on October 5th, 6th, and 7th when the jury came on for this case.
I think that from an evidentiary standpoint, what you're telling us is that your position is the information in this document was otherwise admitted and unobjected to, and so it's of no moment whether the cumulative document came into evidence or not.
That is absolutely my position, Your Honor. And furthermore, counsel's argument also sidesteps the fact that in large part, the delay in this case, the 2.5 years that this case was pending, largely can be lain at the feet of Amy and her actions. It was Amy's decision to hire and fire 4 sets of attorneys, which obviously adds delay and time and expense. It was Amy's decision to go back to the trial court at least twice, asking the trial court to change the temporary orders. Days and days worth of testimony was taken in those motions. It was Amy's decision to request a jury trial, which obviously adds more expense, adds more time, adds delay. And without a doubt, it was Amy's first allegation to CPS that Edward had sexually molested their daughter, which caused the resetting of the trial date. And so it's talking out of both sides of your mouth to, on one hand, to argue that there's reversible error because these temporary orders went on for 2.5 years, and it's not fair then that the jury knew about that. But on the other hand, it was largely your actions that caused the 2.5 year delay. The other issue that counsel brought up in oral argument specifically was that of the testimony of Dr. Michael Flynn, who was court appointed to conduct a social study in this case. And as your honors are well aware, when it comes to credibility of the witnesses, who to believe, who to disbelieve, how to resolve inconsistencies in testimony, that is the sole province of the fact finder, whether that's the jury or the trial court. And expressly, the Texas Supreme Court and other courts of appeal have expressly held that even when it comes to expert testimony, that the jury is permitted to accept lay testimony over expert testimony. So in reality, whether or not Dr. Flynn's report had holes in it, whether his methodologies were suspect, whether we agree or disagree about whether or not he filled out the requirements in the Texas Family Code, it's really kind of irrelevant. Because whether his report was perfect, whether he crossed every T and dotted every I, doesn't really amount to a difference from the perspective that y'all are in, because the jury is permitted to either believe him or disbelieve him. Counsel argues that these problems that we brought up with Dr. Flynn's report at trial somehow was some kind of undue influence on the jury or something to that extent, but that's a matter for cross-examination. The jury heard the cross-examination both ways of Dr. Flynn as to whether or not it really was something that he complied with the Texas Family Code or he didn't. Obviously, our position is that he did not comply with all the pieces of the Texas Family Code. But from an appellate perspective, I don't know how relevant that is when the reality is juries are always allowed to accept lay testimony over expert testimony. But especially in this particular case, when you do consider some of the issues that we had with Dr. Flynn's report. And the issue that I personally have the biggest problem with Dr. Flynn's report is his refusal to interview collateral contacts that Mr. Halliman suggested that he speak with. And instead, he spoke with the child's daycare teachers. And his reasoning for this at trial that he told the jury in the trial court was, well, generally speaking, teachers are pretty objective and unbiased, and people like neighbors or coworkers have an agenda and they haven't observed both parties. That was his reasoning. Maybe that's true generally. Maybe in the typical case, that may be true in Dr. Flynn's experience. But in this particular case, it was the exact opposite, to where the coworkers and the neighbors that Mr. Halliman suggested that Dr. Flynn speak with on a collateral basis knew these parties for many years. These parties met at work. They met at American Airlines, where they were both employed. So the coworkers had the chance to get to know both of them individually. They saw them through their courtship, through marriage, through having Logan. So the people at work were the kind of people that didn't have an agenda, that did have the chance to observe both of the parties. And the same is true for the neighbors that lived on the street for years and years. So when Dr. Flynn uses these generalizations for why he didn't speak with some of these collateral contacts, I think that's a problem, when in reality, in this case specifically, that wasn't the case.
Again, to follow up on your previous line of argument, I mean, your position would be it's immaterial whether he did his job or not, but as long as he was able to put his position and why he did it in front of the jury, and you were able to cross-examine and put your position as to what he didn't do in front of the jury.
Absolutely. When you look at the appellate standard of review for a jury verdict, it is just a typical factual sufficiency review. And what that says, and what it says in the cases that both parties have cited to you, is that you look at all of the evidence before you, and I agree with Mr. Orsinger, you don't put anybody's evidence in more favorable light. You put put all the evidence on the table, and you basically have to decide, was the jury's decision so clearly wrong or manifestly unjust when you look at all of that evidence? That's what a factual sufficiency review is all about. Mr. Orsinger briefs and talks about this zone of reasonable disagreement with jurors, and he pulls that language from the Texas Supreme Court case of City of Keller versus Williams. On further review of City of Keller versus Williams, and I'll cite the court beginning on page 822 of that decision, I believe City of Keller deals most strongly and most specifically with a legal sufficiency review. And when you look at that language about a zone of reasonable disagreement, you're looking at legal sufficiency language all through this opinion. So I don't believe that this is necessarily the language to pull from in City of Keller. And when you go and you look at the cases, the family law cases, which City of Keller is not, and you look at the family law cases since City of Keller, they don't quote that language for a factual sufficiency review of a jury verdict. So Justice McCoy, you're absolutely correct in that we look at all of the evidence that's before us, and we basically make a decision. Did the jury get it so wrong? Was it manifestly unjust what they decided? And when they had before them Dr. Flynn's report, holes or no holes in it, and they were able to hear all of that testimony, and they were able to look at Dr. Flynn as he was testifying, engage his body language, engage his facial expressions, and hear how that cross-examination went, they were able to make that decision whether or not they believed him or not.
Can you take 1 minute to touch on the family?
Absolutely. When it comes to the appellate, and I assume, Justice McCoy, you're asking about the appellate attorney's fees issue.
Exactly.
When it comes to the appellate attorney's fees issue, My first concern is that we have been over this before. The trial court had several instances to look at this $95,000 conditional appellate attorney's fees award and reconsider it. Then in November of this year, Amy brought before this panel and this court a mandamus action complaining about the $95,000, and pursuant to that decision in November 2011, y'all clarified the order some but didn't change the $95,000. So here we are again continuing to argue about it. I believe mandamus is the proper remedy under all the case law and the statutory authority. She had her chance at mandamus. Y'all issued your opinion. If she's still dissatisfied, she can mandamus it to the Texas Supreme Court. So I'm not sure that procedurally she should have what would be a third bite at the apple here today on it.
We didn't exactly review the merits of the attorney's fee issue. We just said that it was postponed until after final judgment.
And I don't disagree with that in the opinion that issue was not fully gotten to and developed. But at the same time, I believe that mandamus is the proper remedy, and I believe that Amy had the option to mandamus to the Texas Supreme Court if that were the case.
The proper remedy, because mandamus is only if you don't have an adequate remedy on appeal, and here we are, so there's an adequate remedy on appeal.
Well, this court dismissed the appeal she tried to bring on it for want of jurisdiction, and the reasoning behind that is under Section 109.001 of the Texas Family Code, which deals with temporary orders pending appeal in a SAPSTR-related issue. It specifically says that this provision is not subject to interlocutory appeal, leading the conclusion that other courts of appeals have made that mandamus is the proper remedy.
Or appeal from final judgment.
The courts...
Two options there.
Sure, absolutely. But the courts that have looked at the issue before, the other appellate courts, those being In re Garza specifically, which is out of San Antonio, have felt that mandamus was the proper remedy in this case, in cases brought under 109.001.
I guess just bottom line is what we're saying is, if you want a remedy, then it's mandamus, it's not interlocutory appeal.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't preclude you from bringing it during the regular appeal. That's kind of what it seems to me, which is where we are now.
And if that's how the court feels, then absolutely, you know, we're here to talk about the merits of the $95,000. And when you look at the statutory authority and you look at the case law that's in this area, it really comes down to whether or not the trial court heard sufficient testimony and evidence that those fees were necessary for the preservation of the property and for the protection of the parties during the appeal. I see I've run out of time. I would rely on the briefing that I do believe the trial court heard sufficient evidence to support the judgment under an abuse of discretion standard.
Thank you. Ms. Teller. Okay, Mr. Orsinger.
May it please the court. I'd like to begin by addressing Justice McCoy's question to Ms. Tillery about whether or not the temporary orders were offered for a limited purpose. If you look at that supplemental reporter's record on page 222, trial counsel for Mr. Howman offered respondent exhibit 17, that was the temporary orders. Ms. Howman's trial counsel objected. Judge, we object to this as an improper comment on the courts. He was cut off by Mr. Howman's trial counsel, who said, this is the temporary order in the case. Ms. Halliman's trial counsel said, Judge, this is prejudicial. It's not necessary. He testified what these things are. It's duplicative. And the court said objection is overruled. And there was no indication from the record that the temporary orders were admitted for a limited purpose.
I was just sort of suggesting that if his lawyer offered them and they were admitted, that her lawyer probably should have been asked the court to admit them for a limited purpose.
Understood, Your Honor. And the point with admitting the temporary orders isn't that it's a problem with what had been going on over the last 2.5 years while those temporary orders were in effect. The problem is when you introduce a court order as an exhibit, it gives an unfair or prejudicial gravity to that particular piece of evidence, and that
adjudication of the court in the minds of the jury because of the statements in those orders that Mr. Orsinger read out loud originally. With regards to Justice Meyer's question to Mr. Orsinger about the zone of reasonable disagreement and where the jury comes into play there, our position about the reasonable norms and the zone of reasonable disagreement is that when you consider the evidence as a whole in this case, it's obviously conflicting. It's hard to imagine that there could be two accounts of situations more conflicting than these parties were. But the issue actually in this appeal is whether it was reasonable for the judge and for the jury to entirely reject so much of the objective evidence that was out there and favor instead the self-interested and subjective evidence of just one of the parties. With regards to the arguments that were made against Dr. Flynn, that we believe the jury improperly considered those arguments regarding whether or not he followed the family code's dictates in the interview of the child and in the interview of the collateral witnesses. Those are legal arguments. They aren't arguments where you ask the witness whether they did one thing on cross-examination and then you have an opportunity on redirect to rehabilitate the witness. These were legal questions about whether or not that expert witness had fulfilled his duty, and there was a correct and an incorrect answer as to whether or not he had fulfilled those standards under the family code. Those weren't, because those were legal arguments, they weren't exactly proper for the jury to be considering when they were determining whether or not to believe Dr. Flynn's testimony and adopt his recommendations. Jumping over to City of Keller, Ms. Tillery said that the language in that case is more of a legal sufficiency language than factual sufficiency. The paragraph where the zone of reasonable disagreement comes from, and I'll read it out loud real quickly. Whether a court begins by reviewing all of the evidence or disregarding part in a legal sufficiency review, so the reviewing all the evidence is the factual sufficiency, there can be no disagreement about where that review should end. A reviewing court cannot substitute its judgment for that of the trier of fact so long as the evidence falls within this zone of reasonable disagreement. So the City of Keller case and this principle of the zone of reasonable disagreement does apply in both legal sufficiency analyses and factual sufficiency analyses. And we've got the factual sufficiency component for the jury's verdict here and then the dual legal and factual sufficiency for the abuse of discretion standard that applies to the rights and duties of conservatorship and the property division, which
the distinction between a legal review and a factual review is both zone of reasonable disagreement.
It's the inference. Under the no evidence standard of review, you disregard all of the evidence that is not favorable or does not support the judgment, and you only consider the evidence that supports it. So you have to look at you're still looking at the zone of reasonable disagreement, but you're looking at the zone of reasonable disagreement with regards to either the record as a whole or only one small part of the record. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counselor. Thank all of you for coming. Your case is submitted, and we will adjourn the court.